And once you see one video, the algorithm shows you 10 others.
Right.
So it's people are seeing this and everybody's seeing it. And that creates resentment and that creates anger. And then people say, well, where are the Jewish voices? And the Jewish voices are small. We know them because we are very attuned to it, but the general public doesn't know who they are.
Welcome to Crossing Faith. Today we have a very special guest, Ms. Daisy Khan, who's the executive director of the Women's Islamic Initiative in Spirituality and Equality. She's an advocate, commentator, trainer, author. We've known each other for some time, but I wanted to have her on to speak about Islamophobia today and the rise of Islamophobia. Thank you for coming on, Daisy.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be with you on this very special month that we are observing.
It's special, but it's tough. We were talking a little bit before, and you know, we had that moment of time where you know, it's we're both fasting, and there's no, as you say, no caffeine, no water, so we might be talking a little bit slower, and we might be having that sort of Ramadan gait. To our conversation, and then you turn up the camera because of the quality of your computer. And the first thing I said was, "Do you have a bucket of chicken there? Are you?"
Well, people don't realize that Muslims in Ramadan, it's not like intermittent fasting, friends. This is like sleep deprivation. You know, because we have to wake up in the middle of the night, our sleep gets disrupted. Some of us can go back, some of us cannot. Usually, caffeine deprived, so you have no that bowl of energy that we get. You are thirsty, slightly dehydrated because you're really not even drinking water, and of course, hungry. And so, but this prevents us from having those knee jerk reactions because we are sort of like, very calm, you know, low energy. And so we don't react to things right away. We don't get angry right away. So that's the positive aspect of it. It really, really makes you as angelic as you can be.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where, you know, I spend quite a bit of time, you know, it's very, you know, introspective. It was funny. We were speaking about the, I remember when I was at the American Islamic Congress, 2013, 2012, when we were cranking on events and sundown was like 9 or 9:30 at night.
Yeah.
And it was so tough. Now it's not so bad because it's 7. But then we had the two moons in Islam, and where you know, we get the Shia and Sunni moon.
The Sunni moon and the Shia moon. I'm like, why can't the Sunnis convert to, Shias convert to Sunni? Because the Shia moon is 20 minutes later. I remember I went to an event and I was ready, you know, when my call to prayer went off on my phone, I was ready to chomp into my dates. And all the people are telling me, no, it's not time yet. It's just 20 more minutes.
Yeah.
I was like, why? And that's when I realized that there's actually two moons.
Yeah, there's 2 minutes. Yeah. And so that in itself is a whole nother song and dance, you know. So, you know, there's the nuances of how the you know, sort of interfaith community interacts with each other. But it's a great story. You know, you're sitting there and you want to be respectful, but now you're like, you sit there and go, what are we doing here? You know, 20 more minutes.
The longest minute, by the way.
For what? No, and so, but I wanted to, I appreciate you taking the time, and you know, Ramadan Kareem, and we're kind of during the holy month. It's you know, we chatted about doing this before Ramadan, but you know, maybe we could just start off with there's been a rise in persecution around the world, but particularly in the United States. And a rise in anti-Semitism and a rise of Islamophobia as related to the events that happened on October 7th. And maybe we could just take a step back and, you know, how do you define Islamophobia?
Well, the definition is, irrational fear of Muslims. It's also referred as anti-Muslim racism, because it has some racist elements to it, because sometimes you are brown and you are perceived as a Muslim. It's also hostility towards Islam, prejudice and hatred of Muslims, and it results in unfair discrimination against Muslims. And also exclusion of Muslims from political and social affairs. So that's really how how it is perceived and how it is experienced by Muslims.
And so, I mean, and the when it comes to fear, I think a lot of Islamophobia came out of 9/11, and for people feared Muslims because they didn't know who they were. They've never met a Muslim, and we had this horrendous attack. And so I was heavily, as were you, involved in advocacy from 9/11 all the way through to I kind of got out of that business around 2015, 2016. But the idea of the fear and its association with terrorism, it was very real for Americans. And so, how did during that time dealing with tackling the idea of fear of Muslims, how did what was like the initiatives or some of the engagement that you did to combat that?
Well, like you said yourself, in the very beginning, that the fear really comes from not knowing a Muslim. So now, before I answer that question, let's even go back some years before 9/11. This all started in 1979. So Islamophobia gets triggered not because of Muslims living in America who are mostly law-abiding citizens, contributing to their communities, to their societies, highly successful, but it gets triggered by external events that then are reported in the press. So for the last 40 years, there has been nothing but negative events being reported that are linked to Islam somehow and linked to terrorism, and then by extension, linked to Muslims. So you have the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, which for how long did that hostage crisis last? Remember, every single day, every single night, you would
Yeah, for
see.
530 days. Yeah, it was something. Yeah.
We had those special day one, day two, and you would see the hostages. And there were these death chants against America, right? And you would see people protesting on the streets and women in chadors, and it was all negative. And there was no positive, because there were hardly any Muslims that were, in the media that were speaking about it. There was no. So the whole conversation was framed that, since Iranians hate America, Iranians are Muslim, therefore all Muslims must hold the same belief, right? So that got entrenched. And then after that, you had 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, you had this terrible linkage to terrorism, linking Islam to terrorism. So now Islam is linked to terrorism, and Muslims then are by extension terrorists, and that created a fear of Islam itself. And the fear of Islam is also then fear of Muslims. And so that gave us that. And then we went and did Operation Enduring Freedom. We went to Afghanistan, and you had this Taliban's brutality against women, which was impossible to defend. And so the perception got shaped that all women are oppressed. So that's also part of Islamophobia. So now you have terrorism, and then you have Islam being misogynistic, and all women are, oppressed. And then you had, then you have, after that, you have the Daesh, ISIS, and Daesh coming on board. Remember those guys? And that, created another fear that somehow Muslims are required to establish an Islamic state because that's what they called for, right? They called for caliphate. And they were walking around with these black flags that had the seal of the prophet on it, and because they wanted to mobilize their people, so they were weaponizing religion. And now you have war in Gaza. And so all of a sudden, people who are calling for Palestinian freedom then are equated to supporting terrorism. And so we have had 40 years of negative perceptions being shown, negative framing of Muslims and Islam being reported in the press every single time. And there is no alternative narrative because many because we don't have, you know, I've gone on a lot of media, but that's just, you know, I'm a commentator. I go once in a while. But generally speaking, when you are seeing these images for such a long period of time, certain ideas and get entrenched in people's minds. And that's the tragedy. It's not that American Muslims have anything to do with this and that they should fear, that America should fear American Muslims, their neighbors, their doctor, whoever they might be interacting with. So this is what's created this tragic perception and this rise in Islamophobia. But today, you know, we are at the point where now there are many more Muslims. Muslims have come of age. There are, you know, young people who are very active. Many, many more people. There are many Americans have a Muslim doctor. They might have a neighbor. So people are now able to interact with Muslims on a one-on-one basis. And when that happens, everything changes because people now know who their friends are. They know the values of Muslims. They know they're law-abiding. And so the fear, you know, then gets reduced because of, or gets removed altogether because you have a personal friend. So it's really important if people want to understand, you know, Muslims, to befriend a Muslim. That's one of the suggestions I give to people. Befriend a Muslim, find a Muslim. If you have a Muslim neighbor, go break bread with them.
Yeah. Well, and this is the month to do it. You know, iftars, do Rosa and Iftar, and which is the breaking of the fast. And you know, this is the time to socialize, right? And good to have some, and really kind of lean on the Muslims you know to get some good food.
Yeah. Well, that's the one big contribution that we are making to America is, like, you know, kebab is becoming the new king. You know, we have hummus being served on planes, and you know, you have biryani in certain quarters where truckers are eating biryani. I mean, you know, we are the world community. We are not just one community. We bring a lot of richness to America. We are adding to the fabric of America in very significant ways. When people actually experience that and they come to our celebrations and they see the kind of food that we have, it's so authentic, it's so delicious. And Muslims generally are very hospitable people. This is part of our DNA. Hospitality is so ingrained in our cultures, and there's abundance of everything. And then you asked me earlier, what was the response to 9/11? This was the response, opening doors up. And basically, you know, I remember there was so much fear in the Jewish community of Muslims. And when I had come to America, I had landed in a Jewish neighborhood. So I knew a lot of Jewish people intimately. You know, I babysat them. I knew their way of life. I ate matzo ball soup with them, had pastrami. You know, I kind of got into Jewish life, and you know, they were my neighbors. So when I saw the fear amongst the leaders, I was like, wait, I already know Jewish people. This can't be. Why are they fearful of us? So I said, you know, let's have a dinner. Let's break bread. And I invited, you know, about six rabbis and about six Muslim leaders. And we were just sitting, and you know, it was in our office. And I had a Jewish friend, and I asked her, what should I get? She says, well, you got to get kosher. And I said, okay. So I made a list of things that I could order. And this is, JT, this is just to show you how funny things can get, you know. Right. And so I ordered my green beans and salmon and, you know, all the things from the finest caterer. And when the first rabbi walks in, he says, oh, he saw the food and he just, like, looked at it and he's salivating. And he goes, oh, is this kosher? I said, yeah, it's kosher. And he goes, where'd you get it from? I said, oh, I got it from this place. He said, are they kosher? I said, what do you mean, are they kosher? So all my food that I had ordered was not kosher.
It's not kosher.
Not from a kosher place. Right. So I said, but salmon is kosher, isn't it? And he goes, yeah, but you got to get it from a kosher place.
Right. It's got to be from the kosher. Yeah. No, that's the problem, is that's the kosher certification. You know, like,
horror as a guest. And then the second rabbi walks in, kind of like looking at the other rabbi, and he was not conservative. And he says to me, he says, if he's not going to eat it, I can't eat it either. So,
oh my gosh. Yes. Yes.
I was not going to have any food for the rabbis. And then we walked into the kitchen and the rabbi said, let me go to your kitchen. And because I had grown up in a Jewish neighborhood, I had matzah ball, matzahs. He opened up the cabinet. He saw matzah there. And then he opened up the fridge and there were two jars there. And one was called Moishe's and the other one was called Ali's, Moishe's and Ali's. And he saw the label and it said, made in Israel. This was a gift that was given to me by the gentleman who now owns Kind Bars. He had started a business with Israelis and Palestinians, and he had created these jars like of spreads, you know, like olive spread. And when this guy saw that, and he saw that in this Muslim office, there's a Moishe's and Ali's, which was unsealed. So he said, oh my God, it's unsealed. Mean it hasn't been tampered with. It's technically kosher. So that was the food that we gave to everybody. And then the most important thing that happened, there is a serious side to this and a transformative side to this. One of that same rabbi said he had to leave to go to take a plane. And so the imam said to him, where are you going? He said, I'm going to Israel. He said, Rabbi, where were you born? He said, I was born in Brooklyn. He said, when you go to Israel, kiss the ground for me. And he said, oh, why do you want me to kiss the ground for you? He said, because I am Palestinian. I was born in Ramallah, but I cannot go there, but you can. So right. You can.
Wow.
And that is everything changed. Everything changed at that moment. The realization of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and realizing something as you're sitting in front of another person who's, you know, on par with you, who's a religious leader, that moment, I think, was the transformative moment. And then we really began to talk seriously about important issues. Those relationships have continued on to this day and have sustained us over many, many, many periods that have been very difficult periods. You know, the Intifada, the other war on, you know, when the settler movements, all these things. So we always come together to see how we can solve these issues, because these are people that are people of the Torah, and then we are Muslims who also want to see a resolution to the Palestinian issue. So right now, the problem is that the issue, these people don't have a voice anymore. They don't have a voice. Just like when we didn't have a voice, when Al-Qaeda and ISIS and, you know, Daesh were running around defining the agenda for Muslims. So the whole agenda for the Jewish people is being defined by Netanyahu and his cabinet, which we all know they're all extremists. You know, just like we have extremists, they're extremists. And they don't want a solution to this. And I know many Jewish people that are against the occupation, that don't want this. And so the result of this, tragically, is that the anti-Semitism has gone through the roof. And at the same time, Islamophobia has gone through the roof because, you know, because every time you see a demonstration, these people are being now called, you know, terrorists, or linking them to Hamas, or linking them to terrorism. So again, that fear of terrorism and that fear of Muslims, then some people act on that fear, not realizing that these are just people that are demonstrating because they have the right to demonstrate in America. This is a, you know, a fundamental right we have to freely express ourselves, to peacefully express ourselves. So,
well, I think, you know, your element of, you know, is like I said, breaking bread, you know, interacting, and you have now a funny story of kosher, not kosher, you know, but the idea of building those relationships through, you know, a like you said, a transformative moment of a rabbi going back to Israel and an imam who can't, but those relationships are the first, are really sort of the first foundational elements, because you have somebody to call if you have a question, you have somebody to engage with if you need advice and guidance. And, you know, it's the sort of the hallmark of this podcast is, you know, I reached out to you because this, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on, certainly right now with Islamophobia. And so, and I'm a little bit removed because of my advocacy has changed. And so we've got now this situation, right? So October 9th, there's this attack of Hamas, and immediately, because you have the Israeli response, rise of anti-Semitism, and then you have the cause of the Palestinian people for a right to determination, of self-determination in their land, but then we also have Hamas floating around, right? And so everything starts to get the lines get blurred, because everybody wants a simple explanation, right? So Hamas conducted the attack. Palestinians are protesting, and somehow that gets conflated into a single narrative, which then you have the rise in Islamophobia in America. And so maybe you could tell me, like, what's happening? What have you been seeing? What are the sort of thematic elements related to the rise in Islamophobia since the attacks, since the attack on October 9th? What do you see going on?
Yeah. Well, I think there are some parallels, but not 100%. It's not 100% parallel, but there are some parallels. So just like when 9/11 happened, and this attack was done in the name, done by Muslims in the name of Islam, right? Then Muslims had to carry this burden of having to confront this, or to de-link themselves, all Muslims all over the world, including American Muslims, particularly American Muslims, because we were the ones, you know, literally at the ground zero, right? We were the ones that everybody was looking at. We were the ones that people were lashing out at. They were not lashing out at, you know, so we had to do this de-linking and to separate ourselves from the acts of the terrorists. And we did that very effectively, because no one was preventing us from doing that. No one was calling us a name and saying, oh, you are self-loathing Muslims, right? Maybe some people, you know, would say, well, why are you going overboard? But generally speaking, we were issuing statements. There were Muslim scholars that were issuing fatwas, calling this an act of terror. And Muslims were reaching out to their neighbors. So we had the freedom to separate ourselves as much as possible that we could. I see a similar parallel with the Jewish community. The people that came out right away and de-linked themselves from the actions of the Netanyahu administration immediately, like, you know, killing of babies, justifying the killing of children, and all in the name of, you know, wiping out, basically burning the haystack, justifying the needle, right? That's really what this is about. So, but immediately there were groups of Jewish people that immediately did what we Muslims had done, de-linking themselves from those actions, saying, this is, you can't do this in our name. And you know the groups, you know, the Jewish Voices for Peace, some rabbis that I know, other Jewish voices. But majority of Jewish people that I know have not done what Muslims did, right? Like individual Muslims, like I had to take initiatives. I had to create a round table. I had to separate myself from this. And that hasn't happened because there's a lot of internal pressure for them not to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's, we didn't have that pressure. And so anytime somebody breaks away, they get labeled as an anti-Semite and a self-loathing Jew. And it's very difficult for this community, because they are a small community, right? And they are a community that has deep trauma. So it's difficult on that level. But I think that the way forward is for them to de-link themselves from this administration and from this occupation and from this, you know, humanitarian disaster, because that is what's going to prevent the anti-Semitism from continuing to rise, because it's rising at the level. It's not only, you know, white supremacists now. It's everyday American who's seeing the horrors on their smartphones, because now you don't have to go to a TV to see this. It's on your smartphone. And once you see one video, the algorithm shows you 10 others. So So it's people are seeing this and everybody's seeing it. And that creates resentment and that creates anger. And then people say, well, where are the Jewish voices? And the Jewish voices are small. We know them because we are very attuned to it, but the general public doesn't know who they are. So this has to, I am advising them. This is my advice because this is what we had to do. And you have to separate yourself from the extremists. Otherwise, extremists are going to basically define the agenda for the rest of you, and which they have.
Yeah, we've dealt with that within our community. I mean, I remember in 2000, from 2000, there was very, very, it wasn't, I always tell people into 20 years after 9/11, there's such diversity now in advocacy in the Muslim, in American Muslim community. There's so many different groups now. And it was really just a small number back in the 90s into the 2000s, early 2000s. And now it's so diverse. They represent the issues on a broad scale. They say there's Muslims for Progressive Values. There's the American Islamic Congress. There's Wise Up. You've got all this stuff, and so there's just such diversity now in representing the American Muslim Ummah. And so everybody has to their issues and collaborate. I think that when it comes to, I think the rise of anti-Semitism, it's important that there needs to be that there you know that there is a narrative and what and that there's an idea that that narrative can be spoken about openly without using all the pejorative terminology and the slogans being thrown around so that so that people are aware that there's an effort for peace, an effort for reconciliation, an effort for all that. And I think it's tough though because that's the rise, then you get the rise in anti-Semitism, but we also are dealing with it with our community. And so how would you characterize it with the Islamophobia, and how would you characterize the Muslim, what's happened since October 9th to the Muslim community?
So since October 9th, it has been very difficult for the Muslim community because, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking, before you had, Islamophobia, it's not only felt at a individual level, it's also felt at institutional level, right? So for instance, when Islamophobia began and you had the war, you had 9/11, we had the war on terror, right? And that war on terror then resulted in so many initiatives, the Patriot Act, stop immigration from Muslim countries, the Terrorist Refugee Infiltration Prevention Act, put a moratorium on Muslims coming from different countries. You had, this perception that Islam is not a real religion, that it's a political ideology. You have this introduction of these bills that were being passed in that were passed in 22 states, blocking Sharia law because somehow Muslims were going to bring their own religious law into American and integrate it into American law. And some of these bills were actually passed. 16 states introduced them. And then you have this clash of civilizations. And so you had the Muslim ban, remember that? Then you have, somehow mosques are a threat to the neighborhood. Again, a perception that was created. And you have all these legal hurdles that are initiated to delay projects. Remember, in 2010, I was trying to build a community center in Lower Manhattan. And it was this whole machinery that went against us to prevent us to delay the project, to place hurdles, legal hurdles, or opponents coming and rallying on the streets, threats of arson, vandalism. This is all being experienced by Muslims anytime. They're trying to build a mosque. There are all these, hurdles being placed. So now you have this whole new perception that somehow people that are protesting, the students, the ordinary person who's a worker in a corporation who goes to a march and then comes back the next day or is notified by text that they are no longer working there. They've been fired. So It's a whole new level of, you know, you have doxing, people are getting doxed. You have free speech is being curbed. There are a lot of online attacks and unfair termination. Employee offers are being rescinded just because you posted something on social media. Charities are under attack. There are some charities that are trying to raise money for humanitarian causes. And the people that are providing tents and supplies are being told not to send them, you know. And then you had this little boy, 6-year-old Chicago boy, Wadia Al-Fayoumi, who was stabbed 26 times by his family's landlord in Plainsfield Township in Illinois. And this was a guy, the 71-year-old man, you know, he built a treehouse for this kid. And this kid used to call him grandpa. So when grandpa knocked on the door, the kid happily opened the door. And then the guy stabbed him 26 times because he had seen something on TV that day that angered him. And then you have this man, Seldowitz, a former State Department employee, threatened a street vendor in Manhattan, you know, accusing him of being ignorant and not speaking English.
Right. Yeah.
Remember that? It was horrible. And making derogatory comments about Prophet Muhammad. And he lost his job and was detained. But here's the good news. The mayor of New York and governor of New York denounced his behavior, calling him vile. And Adams, Mayor Adams said, Islamophobia is hate, plain and simple. This vile, disrespectful rhetoric has no home in our city. And so Julie Menon, whom I know, she said, this individual targeted the street vendor day after day after day, threatened the vendor, clearly committed hate speech that was violent in nature and contained threats.
It was outrageous. Yeah, this was like, you know, because, and they're stuck there. You know, there's this event, they're just trying to sell whatever, kebab or whatever. You know, it's amazing.
I'm selling kebabs every single day. He's probably the lowest on the social totem pole of the Muslim community who has probably just come to America maybe 4 or 5 years ago, is working probably from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. because he has to cook the food, bring it here, lug his cart over there. He's there feeding people every single day. And he has to go through this, and he's been threatened by this guy, a highly educated person. And but you know, he's become a hero now. I mean, this cart is now surrounded by, like, you know, chalk marks on the streets and flowers, and he's like a local hero because he was so dignified. He stayed quiet. He didn't say anything to guy, but of course, he was smart enough to have a phone there, so everything was recorded. But this is the level that people are experiencing. People are not even, some people are being refused bank accounts because they have a Muslim name. So it's called, you know, debanking or unbanking. So there's so Islamophobia is not just, you know, you doing a hate speech or saying something. It's you could lose your job, you know. There's a lot more things going on than people realize. And I just want our American friends to realize that this is being experienced by Muslims at many, many different levels.
Yeah, it's you know, I think, you know, with all the movement that we've had since 9/11, you know, all it takes is a little bit of a flash, you know, and it doesn't maybe go all the way back, but there's been a lot of very positive things that have happened. I mean, I was in business prior to working at the American Islamic Congress, and I just felt compelled as I need to kind of put my government relation powers towards working on these issues, you know. And but I think that there's a character to what's going on right now, that the sort of casual nature of dipping back into Islamophobic sentiments or anti-Semitic sentiments. It's a, you know, sort of like that, you know, day walkers, you know, the idea that everybody's fine, but then at a moment when there's an opportunity to jump on that, people do. And it's unfortunate, but it's part of the character of the environment that we live in right now. You know, you're talking about what people are receiving, sort of doxing and getting their social medias looked at if they advocate for something, then they get hit. I mean, I just went through something just recently where I don't do these posts and so forth, but I was trying to get an expert to talk about genocide. And he basically said he's not going to talk on the podcast because, I'm a denier. And I said, I'm trying to get you as an expert to speak about a designation that you made with your organization. And he was so fast to jump to put me in a box and say, this is who I am, when I haven't even advocated, I haven't even spoken about what I've advocated for with regard to Israel Gaza, which is, this platform is pretty wide. You know, we try to have everybody have a say and trying to get into and unpack some of these things. But it's strange because it comes out in strange ways. And that there's implicit and explicit ways. Like explicit is this vendor, you know, that the child has gotten stabbed. But then there's these implicit ways where it's, I'm not going to do business with you. Or they use platitudes to send and hyperbole to push you away and then appear righteous. And so it's really, really odd and strange. What have you been doing to combat this? What's your schedule like? Are you advocating? Are you doing trainings? Like what's been your agenda related to this, or has it affected your agenda?
Well, it has, but before I go into that, I just wanted to say there is one thing that was a big difference between Islamophobia after 9/11 and Islamophobia after the war in Gaza is the response from the president. Right after 9/11, George Bush came out and made sure that he went to a mosque, and then he said that Islam is a religion of peace. And he basically let Americans know, you got to distinguish between Islam, the religion that Muslims are practicing here and everywhere else, and the terrorists. And that, so we did have few attacks, but we didn't have the level of Islamophobia that we have right now. And right now, if you see—
Interesting distinction. It's a very interesting distinction.
What the president has said, he hasn't said a single word about Palestinian death. He hasn't said anything about— You know, there is an imam in New Jersey who lost 70 family members. The president of the United States has met families whose loved ones are hostages. Yes, and for right reason, he should meet them. But he hasn't met a single Muslim who has lost an entire family. And so this gives out the signal that somehow then people can, in their minds, continue to conflate this thing that somehow Muslims and Islam and terrorism are linked. And by the way, all these people who are demonstrating on the streets are linked to that, you know? So this is a very important distinction. External factor can really affect, or external communication from the highest office can really, have an impact on the general public. If the president had come out and said, there's a war, there's Hamas, but please, let's just make sure that you distinguish between your fellow Muslims here, you know, that would have a very important communication, but he hasn't done that.
In my belly, I want to ask, why do you think that? And maybe it's, you know, and you don't have to answer the question, but what's the logic model there? I mean, you know, is it just, why would you characterize the reasoning for that? Because Bush did it, and you know, American Muslims are part of the fabric of American society. We're here to stay, and so what do you think? Is it just an oversight? How would you characterize the lack of response?
I think that he did say one thing, but he did use 9/11 and said to Netanyahu, don't do what we did. In other words, you know, we made a mistake, right? We went to Iraq, we went overboard, we overreacted, and he did say that. So that was an important signal. But Netanyahu's not paying any attention to him because he has his own agenda. So I think that their foreign policy hasn't been thought out at all. They have not realized what the implications of this are. They're just going and just reacting. And they did come out and say that they are going to do a White House strategy against Islamophobia, but that was something that was already in the works 6 months prior. And but the White House strategy is going to roll against Islamophobia is going to roll out. So, which hopefully down the road there's some hope that some of these things will get shaped. But as far as I'm not waiting for that because it could be months from now. So in the meantime, what I've been doing is I have personally experienced Islamophobia, literally since witnessing it. From the Iranian Revolution onwards, and then personally experienced it firsthand in 2010 when I was trying to build that community center. So, because I have a lot of experience in this subject, personal experience, lived experience, and my community, I have, I'm tapped into my community, so I always hear what's going on. So, now corporations and law firms and other businesses are reaching out, and they also want to bring this conversation because they think it's important for their employees, their team workers to understand how to communicate. Because this lack of communication, this gentleman who didn't cut who didn't want to speak about this issue because of what the implications might be. Imagine in a workplace what the implications are for coworkers not to be able to communicate with one another on such sensitive topic, right? When Muslims are reeling from the death and the destruction, and some personally know people who have died, they are dealing with that. And then the trauma of October 7th for the Jewish community, both of these traumas are being felt simultaneously by both people, right? And the hostages. Some people still have hostages, families that are hostages. So you have these two groups that don't even know how to communicate with one another. So some corporations are bringing me in to do these listening sessions, or do a full-fledged presentation, like an hour long, a 90-minute long presentation to all their employees. And the response is phenomenal because they're doing both trainings on Islamophobia and on anti-Semitism. And it's interesting because the people that are receiving these are saying that they're so appreciative because now they have a nuanced understanding which they cannot get anywhere else.
Right.
And then also we are giving them suggestions on how to communicate with one another in difficult moments like this. And so that's where my work is right now. I'm focused on that, and then I'm also publishing my book on Muslim women's rights on May 21st. So those are my two big projects that I'm working on right now.
Well, so is it I think we have so the trainings and engagement on the corporate level, are you doing any advocacy? Are you is there any are you do you have any advocacy going on, or what advocacy is going on that you're aware of when it comes to Islamophobia?
Well, I think the advocacy part of it is really I'm on the Muslim Jewish Advisory Council, which actually is advocating for Islamophobia to be taken very seriously at the highest office, the White House, and which it was not previously, right? And that is why Muslims became was scapegoated, and we lost a lot of our civil rights. Is because the White House was not keyed into Islamophobia. So, you had the police departments spying on Muslims. You had all these, like I said, the Patriot Act, the special registrations, all of those things were going on because the White House didn't have a strategy on Islamophobia. They just, saw Muslims as a national security threat. So this advocacy, that's the advocacy I'm involved with, on making sure that the strategy to roll out Islamophobia is done effectively and is done with community input, not just something that people in the White House are drafting some document and, that it's the lived experience. So we have conversations, phone calls, Zoom calls, where we are feeding information into them. And then, the strategy will be done in conjunction with Muslim groups. And so that's an indirect, it's an interesting way of taking advocacy and the dialogue work that we've been doing and blending the two together, right? Which usually, yeah, exactly. And hopefully there will be some funds they will allocate for getting the work done. So, real work at the ground level, at the state level, at the community level. And I think that would be, I'm looking forward to that. Maybe there's a silver lining in all these horrendous things that happen that precipitate, something else. And that might be something good that'll come out of this.
Well, I appreciate that. What last sort of on the last note, what would be your if you're speaking directly to the Muslim community or to the non-Muslim community who wants to ha help tackle this issue, where would you point them, and what would be the ask?
Yeah, well, I think right now the easiest thing for Muslims to do is to reach out to their neighbors, to people that they know, and especially make relationships, build relationships with local politicians. Because people always think that somehow change comes from the top, change comes from the very bottom. As you know, it's always grassroots, and politics is all local. So, for instance, there is a little effort that was created last year by a group called Eid Committee, and they just conceived this idea that Ramadan is a special month for Muslims and it should be marked as such, and it should be marked in conjunction with our local politicians. In other words, do a lighting ceremony with a crescent and invite our local mayor, local community to come and join with us to mark this month, just like you have the tree lighting before Christmas. And the idea caught on very quickly, and it was just done in New Jersey in a particular county. And because it was so successful, and there was one gentleman or a group of people who paid for these crescents, somebody paid for the crescents for everybody else. It was amazing, like the best philanthropic effort that could have been possibly made. And this year, I was asked if I could organize one in my community, and I did. And I learned for the first time who my councilman is, how do I get to my mayor, the letter writing, the sending the invitation, organizing this thing, and bringing the community together. So this is the level that the Muslim community is operating at right now, because they are realizing that if they have to get civically engaged, they actually have to start with their absolute local politicians, their mayors, their council people, their board of ed. And it's such a superb development. And it's so nice because the people that never knew us come out and they see an entire community and they see this rich food and they see people's beautiful costumes and they see a community that's vibrant. And they're like, oh, we didn't know these people lived in our neighborhood. We didn't know they lived here. Wow, this is amazing. So this is what Muslims are doing, and Muslims need to do more of. As far as our non-Muslim friends, they need to reach out to Muslims. They need to befriend a Muslim. Believe me, your life will be deeply enriched once you get to know a Muslim on many levels. And I think that those two together have to happen simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, I'm inviting everybody over for iftar, and I'm not sure if they like me or like the kebab, but either way, when we're building relationships, it's always funny. Like, oh, are you gonna make the kebab? Well, then I'll come. That's what they do.
Yeah,
But
the kebab is a definite draw. The kebab is a definite draw.
yeah, I think without a doubt, but anyways, I wanted to make sure that we I wanted to thank you for taking the time. It's not an easy subject. You've got a wealth of knowledge. You're heavily involved in not only with the Muslim community, but on engagement with the multi-faith community out there. So I appreciate you taking the time, Daisy, and we'll have to have you on to talk about the release of your new book,
Yeah.
this Muslim Human Women Human Rights book that you've got coming out.
Great. Thank you so much. I look forward to it. And I want to thank your audience for listening in. I think it's wonderful that this conversation is being, you know, had. And you know, it's, these podcasts are a great place for education. And, you know,
it means a lot for you to take the time, you know, it's just one of these things where, you know, it's out there, it's a word, it's ambiguous, you know, sometimes. And for you to define it and then walk us through that little bit of the history and how it's manifested, its most recent manifestation is, it helps me as someone who's not heavily involved in my community here, but I'm more involved with national security issues. Right. And so it's difficult because it can very easily blossom into something that would be, that could be a catastrophe for all of our communities.